Welcome back to Tasteland. I am your co-host, Francis Zierer.
And I'm Daisy Aliotto.
And today I recorded a solo episode. We're recording this intro together, but Kyla Scanlon joined us, who has, over the last few years, built up a reputation for her ability to digest what's happening in finance and the American economy into really sharp, accessible writing and social media videos. Last year, she published her first book, In This Economy, How Money and Markets Really Work. And if you have not read, watched, or listened to her work, you may have heard the term vibe session, which she coined, and I think is a great example of her style, the way she translates these ideas into really accessible ideas for the internet era. Yeah, it was a great conversation. We talked about friction, one of my favorite themes on this podcast. She just wrote this essay in her newsletter about friction and friction being the most valuable commodity in the world about a month ago. So I really wanted to have her on and talk about that. But it was just me today. No Daisy. Where were you, Daisy?
I'm excited to listen. I was still in the car on the way back from Atlanta, because if you're following the multi-episode arc, I did indeed drive to Atlanta and back. So I drove 7.5 hours today on my second leg and then got out of my car and walked straight into the proverbial studio to record this with Francis.
We're here in the stew. How was the drive? Were you like podcast mode or listening to music? Were you locked in?
I knew you were going to ask me this, so I kept like a careful log of everything I listened to. I was bumping the audiobook for Kitchen Confidential.
Bumping even.
Yeah. I listened to parts of Kitchen Confidential. I listened to a playlist that I had made for Herb Sundays, which is Sam Valenti's wonderful Substack.
Mr. Grizzly. I
jumped around a lot and it felt good. That is the benefit of driving solo. You can make weird decisions like listening to the same song 3 times in a row and then switching genres.
Only 3 times.
I don't know if you do this when you're driving alone, but you always have to have like a little bit of like a fake fight in your car, like an imagined conversation.
I cannot relate.
Maybe that's not a specific issue that you have, but you know, you're at it like, I gesture the air.
As a non-car owner, I'm very rarely driving alone to be
clear. You're not sitting in your car like, you will never disrespect me like that again.
No, I'm not shadowboxing in my car.
Well, I be shadowboxing.
Mm-hmm. Why were you listening to Kitchen Confidential because of the snoozy Weiss?
No, oh my God. I saw that when I got to Atlanta. I had already been listening to it and I was like, you know what? Shut up.
You just turned it up. Turned up the volume.
Exactly. Yeah.
Cool. Exactly. All right. Let's get to the conversation. I had a good time. Daisy, you were missed. But
wait, can I tell you one more thing? Oh, I think this actually has to do with friction.
Well, that was a good friction moment. I was trying to transition.
I know. I broke the rules of improv, but I think this is interesting. So I also listened to the How Long Gone episode where they're talking about the New York Times piece about Gen Z and bar tabs, which I do believe
that came out like today or yesterday.
Yeah, written by our own Paula Mejia.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So anyway, I've never mentioned this to you before. I think a couple months ago, a woman emailed me. She had to email me twice because she astutely realized her first email had gone to my spam box to tell me that she had a bunch of vintage Animal Cracker stuff, like paraphernalia, and she was wondering if I wanted it because she had found my article on the internet about being related to the artist, the Nabisco artist who did the Animal Cracker box and the Ritz Cracker box, among other Nabisco art from that era. And she emailed me to ask me, do I want it? And for free, like, can I just send this to you? I'm getting rid of stuff. Nice. I'm getting older. I'm cleaning out my house. And I said, absolutely. That's so kind of you. I can pay shipping. And she said, don't worry about it. And we had a lovely exchange. And when I walked in my door from Atlanta about 1/2 hour ago, there was a big box sitting on the stairs. Oh, and nice. I was like, what is this? And I looked at the return and I was like, oh, it's the Animal Cracker stuff. And what made me think about friction was like, I kind of think we're like losing the recipes of, I have this thing. I found this person online who has like a connection to it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to like just email them, cold email them.
As opposed to throwing it out or hoarding it forever.
It's just, I mean, it's a very old school interaction, right? She had to put effort into that. She had to go to the post office for me. We don't know each other. And I want to be the type of person who would do that. But I feel like everything in society right now is like molding a generation where that whole start to finish interaction would feel kind of scary and weird for both of us. But
precisely.
Anyway, it was a high friction interaction that like touched me really deeply. And I'm so excited to unpack it. I haven't even opened it yet.
Mm-hmm. A lot to unpack there.
Yeah, a lot to unpack. So,
the Ritz thing, this reminded me of one of my earliest memories of falling for advertising. We always had Ritz crackers in the house when I was a kid. And I remember, I don't know if you remember this, on the sides of them, it was like...
Did you try to make that specific sandwich?
Yeah, it was like midnight snack and it's like ham and cheese. And I was obsessed with like, I need to have ham and cheese on Ritz crackers at midnight.
You were shadowboxing with the
the Nabisco company simply had me by the throat.
Yeah, I'll shout out to Nabisco. Nabisco is sponsored Tasteland. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I would take that Nabisco money.
Yeah, I think it's Kraft money now, right?
Probably. Anyways, speaking of money, Kyla Scanlon knows a lot about it. Let's get to the conversation. Okay, so you wrote this essay in early May called "The Most Valuable Commodity in the World is Friction." And I've been thinking about friction as a lens through which to understand so much going wrong with our culture, our world, economy, et cetera. I've been thinking about this for about like 6 months or so. So I was like, this is like the essay I was looking to read. So to start, what do you mean exactly when you say that friction is the most valuable commodity in the world?
So the essay itself was written after I got stuck in the Newark disaster, you know, the air traffic controllers not being able to like even see the planes in the sky because their technology was breaking down. And this was the same week that the ChatGPT college essay came out from, I think, the New Yorker, where they were talking about how college students were using ChatGPT and just sort of outsourcing all of their cognitive burdens. And I've been like sort of circulating around this idea of friction for a long time. And I was like, wow, there's so much friction in the real world, like so much underinvestment, so much, you know, ignoring these really big problems. And then in the digital world, you can kind of escape all of this. Mm-hmm. And then there was another essay from The Cut talking about the West Village girl and kind of that archetype and how they're able to design a physical life through monetary means of avoiding all friction. Like it just, you know, it seems simple on paper, but so that was kind of the impetus of the essay. It was like, you know, noticing this, as many others have depicted, noticing these really big differences between the digital and the physical, and then those who can afford to curate their physical to have the same frictionlessness as the digital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the digital bit, I think, is the core for me. Like the way I came to it was working in that software companies where you talk about like, oh, we need to remove the friction in our sign up process, or we need to remove the friction, or we need to, you know, add friction to the unsubscription process, whatever it is. It's all about like removing friction to decrease the distance between customer and desired outcome, right? So I think when I started thinking about it, it was that, and it was about like the removal of friction as like a way for companies to get more out of consumers. Sometimes, you know, ostensibly for the benefit of the consumer to make their life easier in using the product, but ultimately for the benefit of company, right? So I thought that putting like, I'm gonna sum up your three distinct worlds. You kind of just did this, but you say that the digital world has almost no friction. The physical world is full of it. And in certain curated spaces, like you were just saying, like the West Village or your AI companion, friction has been turned into something you can pay to remove. A couple longer quotes, and then I'll hand it back to you. You say that this is what a frictionless world looks like. Everything accelerates until you forget what it means to try. And regarding the physical world, you say, because while the digital world has removed all friction, the physical world is where the friction still lives. Not the good kind, the effort of doing something hard, the kinetic potential of possibility, but the bad kind, the exhaustion of trying to hold together systems that no one's willing to invest in anymore. So tell me more about these two, the good kind versus the bad kind of friction, as you laid it out there.
Yeah, I mean, I think like it's obviously personal. Like some people really like, you know, outsourcing everything to an AI agent and not having to worry. And then I think other people would say that there's a lot of value in trying hard and like doing things for yourself. And so I think in the digital world, as you were saying, like these companies have really optimized the apps as to where it is really frictionless. And if it even takes a couple of seconds to load, you're like, what's happening?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You're like, okay, I'm going to go to a different app now. And then in the physical world, you have so much friction. Like I think this example with the air traffic controllers is really important because, you know, there's people's lives that are at risk and it's this immense amount of friction that has to be solved by the correct allocation of capital, like some sort of investment. And we just refuse to do it. But we're willing to invest so much money to reduce, you know, friction in the digital world and throw a bunch of money at like an AI startup. When we have like planes that are disappearing into the sky because ATCs can't find them. So that was sort of the summary of the two types of worlds with one core example for each.
So with, you know, we're talking about technology and how the digital world is frictionless, right? I feel like it's not just like big tech, like not just capital T tech, but the history of technology is basically about removing friction, right? Like you go back to the written word, and that's making it like decreasing the friction between ideas and their ability to travel, right? Like making it so ideas can travel asynchronously. So where I'm going with this is like, is this state of like ultra frictionlessism, kind of a mouthful, is this kind of just kind of like an inevitable thing though? Like, this is just the end point of like technological advancement?
I hope not. Yeah. I mean, I think like there's two ways to look at technology. Like one is through the more optimist lens where it's like, I think technology can be an aid and, you know, there might be some elements of frictionlessness. Like if we could use it to improve healthcare, improve educational outcomes, like that's really great. But then we have sort of dipped into the simulation economy, right? Like where people are choosing to sort of, you know, more or less upload their consciousness and outsource that to an AI machine. And so I think like not all technology is bad. It's just the application of that technology that can make it bad. And like bad's a big word because like I said, some people like this stuff. I just think that there's consequences to it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the liking it, like I like, you know, that I can open my phone and check the weather and et cetera, et cetera, right. Like do all these things like basically instantly. But it's like, is that like when I think about like if this is the end point of technology, it's like, what do you do when there's no friction, right? Like it's just then like even like the service economy, right? The US is now more of a service economy. We're not a manufacturing economy, et cetera, et cetera. Tariffs, trying to reverse that, not going to happen. Summing up a lot there. Mm-hmm. But like in like, I don't know, like once if it's all services, it all just collapses in on itself. I guess I don't know. I guess I don't really know where I'm going with this, other than it just does seem kind of hopeless. But let's back out of this for a second and talk about the simulation economy. So I want to read another quote that you mentioned in this, that you write in this article, which is, I think what we're witnessing isn't just an extension of the attention economy, but something new, the simulation economy. It's not just about keeping you glued to the screen anymore. It's about convincing you that any sort of real world effort is unnecessary, that friction itself is obsolete, which is kind of what we're talking about here. The simulation doesn't just occupy your attention. Instead, it replaces the very notion that engagement should require effort. So tell me more about this simulation economy idea and why you think it's worth labeling it as like this separate thing from the attention economy.
Well, I think I do like how you're like, let's stop talking about the end of the world and instead talk
about
this.
Don't worry, we're going to go back to it.
But I mean, I think the simulation economy is just the next iteration of the attention economy. So in my mind, the attention economy is kind of like scroll, scroll, scroll. You know, you're glued to a couple of screens at once. You have Netflix designing shows that you can listen to instead of have to watch. Like the actual dialogue is changed. So you don't have to like watch that screen. You can like watch TikTok and hear Netflix at the same time.
Classic,
like that's
Emily
sort of
in
the
Paris
attention economy. Mm-hmm. Is that? Yes. Yes, exactly. And then the simulation economy is sort of you disappearing into the technology versus using it as a distraction. So I think with some of the AI stuff, and like, I think AI can have good applications. I just think perhaps we've been using it in ways that are not great, like Cluely, which I don't even want to talk about this company because I think the founder is sort of an engagement hack. You've spilled
plenty ink on it already too.
I know a lot of people have, but I think that like they know what they're doing in terms of capturing the, you know, it's very much flood the zone type stuff that they're trying to accomplish. And I hate giving people like that attention, but you know, they're a good example of this sort of stuff. Like they want to help you cheat on everything and like have these glasses where you can be on a date and have like information about the date. And their core thesis is that you never have to think alone again. And so you're just like, that's a different version of the attention economy. And it's one that is much more immersive. Like there was, a Wired article about 60-hour raves that people are doing and their virtual headsets, you know, job interviews can become browser tricks with things like Cluely. And then you, of course, you can like outsource your writing to ChatGPT. And so you end up having identity as like this efficiency layer, as I write about. And I think that's when things get really dicey in terms of what the economy is relying on, because then you're relying on people to totally tap out.
Yeah, this reminds me of something we had David Rudnick, the designer, on like in November. And I forget how we got on this thread, but we were talking about like, you know, virtual reality headsets meeting like AI generated experiences that are so unique to each consumer, and how that then just creates this sort of like solipsistic society of people standing in their own corners, having their own unique dream. And you can't relate to people on like this specific cultural experience because you had one that was totally customized to you. And so, I mean, that's kind of where my mind is going with how you're describing the simulation economy. Is it's like the ultimate like fracturing of society into these like purely digital, individualized, kind of antisocial experiences.
Yeah. And I think that is the root of a lot of our issues right now. And people have been, you know, this has been sort of beaten to death in the essay world, this idea of like monoculture and how we used to all watch the same TV shows and like listen to the same music. And we were able to have like this thread of connectivity between us. And now everybody's fragmented and you have your own algorithm designed just for you and what you want. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. Like when everybody, as you said, does have their own experience, you know, you work alone, you hang out alone, you get rewarded alone. This is a very extreme example. People, of course, are still hanging out and being together. But, you know, American individualism is a strong force, and we are sort of setting it on fire right now with some of the technology that is available.
So, okay, American individualism. I want to talk about the American dream briefly. So the American dream frictionlessism. In like early March, Scott Bessent, U.S. Treasury Secretary, he was giving a speech to the Economic Club of New York defending the tariffs. And he said this line that I haven't really been able to stop thinking about, as they say, that access to cheap goods is not the essence of the American dream. The American dream is rooted in the concept that any citizen can achieve prosperity, upward mobility, and economic security. And so I kind of totally disagree with that, because I think access to cheap goods and prosperity, upward mobility, and economic security are the same thing, just in a relative sense, because those things imply the relative cost of goods being cheaper, right? So in that same way, I think frictionlessness might be the American dream.
I mean, I think some elements of the American dream are elements of frictionlessness, but the kind that is maybe okay. Like if you're, you know, you don't want to have to worry about if you can afford going to the doctor, like that sort of frictionlessness, I think is okay. But Noam Chomsky, I was listening to an interview that he was doing, and it's like, I don't know, 10 years old or something. And somebody asked him this exact question. It was the guy, the man from Princess Bride. I can't remember his name.
The guy who's like poisoning, like the shorter guy?
Yeah,
or
the shorter guy.
Yeah, what's Andre something? right? Anyways.
No, anyway, yeah. So it was the guy from Princess Bride asking Noam Chomsky. He was like, well, it seems, and this was like 10 years ago or so, and he was like, it seems like the American dream is to be able to sit on a couch, you know, have somebody bring you a hot fudge sundae, and then you're clocked out. And Noam Chomsky answers, and he's like, no, like, you know, you see people wanting to work. You see people still having that desire to like go out there, be in the physical world. And so, I mean, a lot of people have been circling this idea of like what it means to have phones and internet and technology in our lives. And I think that the phones and the social media are just like one of the most powerful drugs that we have, that we have ever had. And so I don't think that the American dream is like outsourcing your entire life to social media and like living inside of an AI bot. I still believe that people like working hard. It's part of the reason that we have such intense populism right now is because people want to bring manufacturing back because they want those jobs again, or so they say. And so I sort of agree with Noam Chomsky here that the American dream isn't bonbons on a couch. It's like having the opportunity to have that upward mobility, which oftentimes does come through working hard. I could be wrong, but
no,
my research.
I agree with
did
you.
Did I misunderstand you?
No, not at all. Okay. I agree. I mean, there's no like, these are kind of vague questions that there's not necessarily one answer I'm looking for, but I agree with you in that, like, I very much believe that like work is a social endeavor and it's good for people to work and like work alongside each other and all this. But maybe it's that like you could say treatlerite economy, where everything, it's like, you know, you use DoorDash in the frictionless economy, let's say, what's being sold is like frictionless. Not that frictionlessness is the American dream, but that it is being sold as that in kind of the platform attention economy era, maybe.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think so. I think to a certain extent, right? In Trader Joe's is sort of like I think a good wrapper.
With a little bit of friction.
Well, and like little treats. Yeah. It, like, right. Like everything is kind of optimized for a millennial experience. And it's like relatively cheap. And so I think that there's a lot of different threads, like really abstract threads that you can pull on and tie together to kind of get into this idea of like, what does it mean to have a frictionless economy? And like the fact that you can get a private taxi for your burrito, it makes your life pretty easy in a way that maybe it shouldn't be. If you just think about how important it might be just go and get that burrito yourself from like a socialization standpoint. And so I think it is kind of complicated because some elements of frictionless are just always going to happen as we have a growing economy. And as, we are a service-based economy, so there are going to be more services that are offered. And so like some of this is inevitable, but I think some aspects, especially those that are related to technology, are making people disappear more than it's giving them opportunity.
Yeah. So I want to, I'm going to read you like my first articulation of this frictionless idea from, this was back in February. I found this tweet, which it was just like a kind of like throwaway tweet, but it ended up like feeling like a distillation of how I was thinking. So I said, it was a reply to something else. I forgot what it was. I tweeted it. Yeah. But it's, so it's, the three tenets of our cultural moment, I say. One is the removal of friction, as seen in sports gambling apps, Zin, and crypto. Number two, entrepreneurialism, like the creator economy and gig economy. And three, decentralization of meaning generally, like Doge or replacing fact checkers with community notes. And I put three there, but I felt like I was really trying to articulate one thing, which maybe just is frictionlessism. I'm curious what you think, if that's all just the same thing of like, if removal of friction, this sort of like entrepreneurialist obsession with in our economy or within the platform economy, really, which I would say is frictionlessism in that it's like removing labor protections and making it like seem like it's all a lottery, right? Like if you play this right as an entrepreneur, you can get rich quite quickly. Less free. I'm really throwing the word friction around in a lot. It gets multiple different ways, but, I don't know. I guess my question is like, is that all just frictionlessism? And is frictionlessism the core of the definitive aspect of like this moment in culture?
I think some of that is. Yeah, I think everything is a little bit like different and they all have different consequences. Like sports betting, that's a very interesting example of, how we've sort of allowed infrastructure in and have really taxed human failure. If you think about, like, you know, states were allowing sports gambling because they wanted that revenue during COVID. Yeah. And so they were like, hey guys, you know, lose a bunch of money on the Bucks. It'll help us. And so that's sort of a strange and perverse incentive, right? And I don't know, like, the elements of frictionless there are that you can just do everything from your couch versus, like, in the, you know, 1980s, you would have to, like, go to a bookie and it was more underground, and now it's really normalized.
Bowling alone. And so I think, gambling alone.
Yeah. I mean, that he was so early with everything. But yeah, so I think that there are many elements of frictionlessness and everything is sort of there.
Yeah. Okay, I promise I'll take us out of frictionlessism soon. I feel kind of, I keep saying frictionlessism, but there's got to be a clearer way to say that. But okay, another recent newsletter that came after the friction one, Economic Lessons from the Screwtape Letters. You continue kind of working on this theme. So I'm going to read another quote from this. Screwtape, for the listener, being this C.S. Lewis book about, like, a demon writing letters to his nephew, right? Mm-hmm. About like how to corrupt people, right? Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. So you say Screwtape would feast here with that slow untethering from reality. The irony is that this convenience was supposed to free us for deeper pursuits. With food delivery, we wouldn't waste time cooking. With algorithmic entertainment, we wouldn't waste time browsing. With frictionless finance, we wouldn't waste time budgeting. But free us for what exactly? The promise was more time for meaningful connection, creative pursuits, deep thinking. Exactly the things that require effort, patience, and resilience. The very muscles that convenience has allowed to atrophy. So I think I just really like this as, like, an articulation of, like, once you remove friction, you don't have a life, because the purpose, put it in another sense, the purpose of life is friction management.
Yeah, it's really crazy to hear your words read back to you. You're like, oh no.
My favorite thing to do on this
podcast. Yeah, it's a great way to be like, oh, I should have said that differently. But
you said it well.
Oh, thank you. But C.S. Lewis in the Screwtape Letters, like, again, another guy that was very early, just like Bowling Alone and Robert Putnam. Mm-hmm. But I think that with that, like, you do have this demon that's, like, training his nephew, and he's like, this is how you're going to get people to defy God and come to our side, like the demon side, the devil side. And he's like, the way that you do that isn't by making them evil. It's by making them boring, by making them flat, mm-hmm. by making them disengaged from the world around them. And so I was rereading that book coming home from a concert in San Francisco. So I was on the plane and I read the book a couple of times, but, like, this time I was like, I just come off the back of the Friction newsletter and I was like, whoa, this is crazy. He wrote everything that I was trying to write and said it so beautifully and through his story, which is always so powerful. But yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of the thing, is like, frictionlessness has allowed us to outsource a lot of our life and kind of like maybe the parts that you find meaning in without even knowing it, like making a budget or, you know, planning for the grocery store or cooking for yourself. Like, there's a lot of value in doing those things and a lot of human spirit in doing those things. And so that entire piece was just kind of, you know, talking about how we can pull forward a lot of the lessons from the Screwtape Letters to the present moment and kind of frame it around this idea of, like, if things get too simple, it's probably not good. It's a very strange argument to make, because you would think that the goal of human life is that you get to the most simplest point possible. And it sounds like a little man, like a little old man yelling at clouds, right? Where it's like, mm-hmm. no, things should be just a little complicated. But I think some elements of that are true.
No, I totally agree. And in that piece, you write about how, like, the market responding to this was like independent bookstores rising. And you didn't specifically use this example, but I think this is what you were referring to. Like, it's is it Borders or Barnes & Nobles? I always forget which one that, like, now has Barnes come back around. Barnes & Nobles. Okay. Yeah. Now they're like doing this thing where they're telling their employees to treat the bookstore more like your typical indie bookstore, with, like, staff favorites, and each one can be slightly different and curated to the specific locale. So I want to talk about refrictionalization and, like, if there's hope for it, I don't know, or, like, how that happens, like, real at scale frictionalization, because, you know, I like the idea of spending less time on my phone, but I don't want to look at my screen time because it's quite high. yeah, I guess I'm curious where your thinking is on like how refrictionalization is happening or could.
I mean, yeah, I think it's things like the independent bookstores. I think it's things like, you know, going to restaurants and doing simple things like that. And of course, all of this is like very nuanced and it's very broad strokes over a very big problem. So it doesn't apply to like all people. Like some people are, you know, not terminally online and might not be facing these issues. And so I always think it's important to shout out that kind of stuff. But yeah, I mean, I think that right now, it's a very difficult time because there is almost this need to be really connected because of the volatility of fiscal policy and just no one knows what's going to happen next. And so people are just constantly tuned in. And when people are constantly tuned in, that really reduces your faculties and it really makes you quite tired. And so you become more prone to doing frictionless type things like where you're, you know, using DoorDash or maybe outsourcing some of your work to an AI chatbot or something like that. And yeah. So all of it does make sense, you know, the convenience aspect.
Yeah, I'll read one more, maybe I have like one or two more quotes from the frictionless essay, from the friction essay. But so at the end of it, you do start to kind of suggest an alternative. You say, but they suggest an alternative to both digital frictionlessness and physical collapse, a world where effort is neither eliminated nor wasted, but directed towards systems that actually sustain us. Maybe it's things like requiring tech platforms to internalize costs they currently externalize to physical systems and human attention, challenging, or educational models that reward deep engagement rather than interface management, also challenging. But we have to acknowledge that when we remove friction from one domain, we're not eliminating it, we're just moving it somewhere new, which previously in the essay you talked about how like every removal of friction is just kind of a mortgaging of it, either like into the future or to another, you know, some other externality. But my thought reading that is like how do we require tech platforms to do that, right? I find it hard to believe that obviously this current government, but even the next government, whatever that might be, would institute these kind of regulations. So I guess my question is like, do you see that happening soon, this kind of like regulatory refrictionalization?
No. I mean, Germany is trying. No. You don't either. Like, no, I don't think anybody does. Like, no. Like nobody's that rosy-eyed anymore, yeah. Or rose-colored, whatever. So, you know, Germany is trying to do a 10% digital tax on the tech platforms.
I don't know about this.
Yeah, Germany's trying to like be like, hey, you have a digital platform, like you're going to have to pay a certain tax on that, mm-hmm. just because of the cost.
A tax on like any transaction that happens on it, a tax on what?
Yeah, so Germany is considering a 10% tax on large platforms like Google and Facebook, and they're mostly doing it to like be like Donald Trump, stop doing tariffs. But yeah. They're just going to sort of tax these platforms that are really important to the United States. And the platforms are also, as Germany said, quite good at tax evasion. They make a lot of money and they don't necessarily pay a lot in taxes. And so I think like, so Joni Ive, he just sold his company to OpenAI for like $6.5 billion in equity. And he has his design company and they're probably going to make some design product. And he was a lead designer at Apple when Steve Jobs was there. And he had this FT piece come out where he was like, you know, there have been these harmful consequences of technology and it's all unintentional. And so I think there's a lot of that with people who have sort of led the charge of technology. Is they're like, listen, we didn't know that the technology would be frying the kids. Like we just thought it would be helping people. And clearly like it's really hurting, like Pal Jobs, Steve Jobs is, wife was also interviewed in an article and she was like, we can see the aspects of technology, like how it's harmed young women, especially, and just how it's really done a number on people. And so I think in terms of just holding people accountable, that's going to be the hardest part, much less making them pay a tax. It's like somebody might have to just answer for the consequences that have been put forward by the platform. So it's really challenging because like with every sort of technology, there's good and bad, right? Like, technology is enabling us to have this conversation via Riverside. And it's also enabled me to like post videos about the economy on social media, to have a newsletter that I distribute via social media. And so there's like good and bad. And that's the hard part about sort of holding people accountable is there is good, but there's also immense consequences. And I think that's where things get really challenging. And a lot of people way smarter than me have been working on these problems for a very long time. And nobody can really figure out how to execute properly.
Okay, we've probably talked enough about friction. Tell me more about the book tour and like any, I don't know, questions that people asked you on the tour that stuck with you, or, you know, conversations that you've kind of been having over the course of the tour.
Yeah, I mean, like any good newsletter writer, I wrote a newsletter about it. And it was called Gen Z and the End of Predictable Progress. Mm. Because like a lot of, you know, I study economy, I study finance, and translate that for people. And one thing I just really noticed in talking to professors and talking to students is that they're just kind of worried. For the first time in a long time, the unemployment rate for college grads is quite high. Kevin Roos talks about this quite well in his new piece on the AI job apocalypse. And, you know, the housing market is quite challenging. And it just feels like, you know, this equation where you would go to college, you'd have a rather predictable return on investment from that college degree, like at least find some sort of job. You would be able to buy some sort of starter home, and then you would slowly progress in your career. Like that has sort of been shattered. And every generation faces their own problems. Like I'm not blind to that, but I think this specific set of circumstances for young people is really important. Because when you think about the lack of early career training and the lack of early career investment, like that is setting them up for a lot of issues down the road, because those first couple of years of your career are where you get, if you choose to enter, you know, the workforce, that's where you get a lot of your training, get a lot of your preparation. And so that's concerning. And then of course, like housing is the foundation for the economy. And if people can't afford a house, like that brings up all sorts of other economic problems. Mm-hmm. And then of course, you know, just the progression of the career is interesting too, because baby boomers are taking longer to retire because they have their own financial problems, right? Like 43% of boomers have no retirement savings. So it's just like, that's just what I've been sort of studying over the past year with the help of these students, is how they feel about their circumstances, and they're worried.
Yeah. I mean, I can relate to that. So in the intro to your book, you say that economic literacy for all, emphasis on for all, has been your mission since high school when you dabbled in options trading and wrote about it for your first blog, Scanlon on Stocks. So my question there is, like, you're just saying how, you know, every generation has its own unique problems with the economy. I think yes, but also like it's always, I mean, yes, unique problems now, but that it's always kind of like the new challenge of like explaining these things to people. And maybe people 50 years ago were more literate in some of these concepts, and it was, you know, easier to, for your average person, I don't know, I'm making this up, but maybe easier for your average person to pick up like an industry rag and read it cover to cover and kind of understand what's going on, where now that's not necessarily the truth. Now, you know, it's people getting stuff from you in your book or, or, you know, on your social media videos or in your newsletter, et cetera. Tell me some of your basic principles or ideas that you try to, flog over and over, like in your work, that you think like meet how people understand economic literacy now. Like what's most important in like, on a repetitive scale for you to get out?
So the book was designed to be a static place that people could go and hopefully have, you know, an accessible guide to the economy. So it's illustrated. It's my drawings. It's meant to be fun and not overwhelming in the way that sometimes economics can feel to a lot of people. And so for me, like the main goal of a lot of my work, the newsletter is a little bit different, but like a lot of my work is about sort of taking these core economic concepts and using both financial and media literacy to explain them to people. So I think the foundation of understanding the economy is understanding how the economy is talked about. And so using, you know, like news and media headlines, and then now sort of the antics of the administration, and being like, look, this is how people are talking about the economy, but this is like actually what inflation numbers mean, or this is actually what we're seeing in the data for the labor market. And so it's a lot of attempting to translate ideas and translate them into a way that's hopefully, you know, applicable, and hopefully they feel like they can take action on. It's been more challenging in recent months just because of the general uncertainty.
The speed.
You know, you'll film a video and then like already the policy has changed by the time you're done. And people are quite tired too. Mm-hmm. And so like before all of this, it was like, okay, I should understand the economy. Like when I go and buy a coffee, like that's an economic transaction, or like I'm in the workforce, that's an economic transaction. I am paying for my car. Like everything, single thing we do is an element of the economy. And we just pretend that people don't need to know about it. And then like, it's like, what? And so, yeah, that's the main driver.
Well, the way you're talking about, you know, buying a coffee, and I think this, you use this example, like right in the, it's like the first chapter of your book, you talk about how like, this is the economy. Later on in your book, at some point you say that people are the economy. And that this is the main theme of your book. I'm not a very, very financially literate person, you know? So like reading your book, it's like, this does, like for me, I feel like I'm the audience that makes it accessible for me. But the way that you say that people are the economy and that's the theme of the book implies to me that that's very different from traditional or mainstream, even maybe like pop economic thinking or writing. Is that true? Like, how is it different? Is that really your novel kind of edge?
I don't know. I think that like people are the economy is important because even just in the data, like 70% of GDP is consumer spending. So it's like people out there spending money on people things. And then the foundation of most economic things are just people like buying stuff, or companies buying stuff, or companies selling things to people that they've bought from overseas, people going to restaurants. And so the economy literally is just like the actions of people. And so I think sometimes people feel like the economy isn't relevant to them, you know, and it's kind of like, well,
cause the economy, you know, your average person, probably me at some point when I'm younger, it's like, oh, the economy is just stocks and I don't own stocks. So why do I care about the economy? That's irrelevant to me.
Oh no. Yeah. That's a very common and understandable misconception. Yeah. Because like when, unfortunately, the way that we oftentimes talk about the economy is through the lens of the stock market. So we're like, and they're very different, right? They're two different things. The stock market is a good barometer for where the economy might be headed because it measures the health of companies. Well, at least it used to. Now it measures share buybacks. But so that is a very common misconception. And I think a lot of people run into that where they're like, this isn't relevant. I don't want to own stocks. I don't care about stocks. But then it's like, well, you know, when it's time for you to buy a house, you need to understand how a mortgage works. You need to understand what inflation is doing. You need to understand, you know, what's going on in the labor market or what the recent GDP print was, because that helps you be an informed citizen and hopefully helps you make informed decisions when you're voting or just when you're existing in the economy. And so that's the goal. Yeah.
You also make a point in the book that GDP isn't really a good measurement of the economy anymore. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, I'm not the first person to say that. A lot of people will just be like, this is not like, you know, it's just not capturing the economy in a way that is most useful for understanding the needs and wants of the people. Right. So like it does a good job at capturing consumer spending, government spending, investment, exports and imports. But when you think about like what the average person is facing, like they're facing healthcare costs and elder care and child care. And like perhaps there's a better way to gauge, you know, the interaction of the average person with the economy rather than this big metric of GDP, which, you know, the measurement can be a little funky sometimes and might not totally capture how people are feeling and how they're spending and what they're doing. It does an okay job, but a lot of people think it doesn't do the best job.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the book, your short form videos, you have a podcast, though. You haven't updated it for like 4 months or so, I think.
Oh my God, don't say that.
We can delete that.
I'm on break.
You're on break. She's on break, everybody. Okay, book, short form video, podcast, newsletter, all these different media where you do kind of express yourself in different ways. I think, like you were saying, the book is meant to be this static object, really accessible. The newsletter is maybe a little more like complex than the videos, which are, you know, pretty short and super digestible. Tell me kind of the relationship between all the different media you put out and how this relates to your whole thing, like how this composes your whole thing.
So the reason I've taken a break from the podcast and from making YouTubes is because I was having trouble figuring out how to do it in a way that was unique, in a way that was like really helping people. And so my short form videos, I think, are useful because like I am able to distill the day's news in an economic lens and hopefully give people something to chew on within a 3-minute segment. I hope to capture them on their daily scroll and then they're like, oh, economics. And then hopefully.
Which you do. I mean, you've got like on Instagram alone, it's like 330,000 followers and these get a lot of views.
Yeah. No, people have been very receptive, which I'm very grateful for. And then the newsletter is more of like the philosophical exploration of the economy. So not just like, okay, it really is like the economy or people. So like, what are people doing inside of the economy? And like, what are people writing about what people are doing? Like, I really love taking, you know, this week's think pieces and kind of tying a thread between all of them, because everybody sort of is saying the same thing a lot of the times. And it's really quite useful, I think, hopefully, for people to see how there's similarities between a lot of these more abstract think pieces. So that's the short form and that's the newsletter. And then the YouTube and the podcast, I'm trying to figure out how to sort of create like the Bill Nye, the science guy, Reading Rainbow, Carl Sagan aspects. And it's just like, I realized that I was getting caught in my own thesis. Like I was getting caught in the attention economy. I was getting totally captured by the algorithm and like feeling forced to post. And it's just like the quality was not great. And I was like, I'm doing a disservice to the audience. I'm doing a disservice to the content. I've actually never talked about this publicly. Sort of like why I did this. I just have never acknowledged it actually. But and that was why I ended up taking a break from that. But the main goal is to develop economic and financial education via media and using it to distill lessons in a way that is hopefully leaning toward artistic.
I'll ramble here for a second. I feel like in preparing for this and, you know, trying to read some stuff, other people have written on you or listening to podcasts you've been on, and people always are referring to you as like the Gen Z economy whisperer, kind of, right? And that's how people have chosen to label you. What it sounds like you're telling me now is that like that's kind of like this label that has been put on you, and you've been doing all this output across all these media, and now you're trying to like actually figure, you're at a point of like needing to sharpen the point and like, why am I doing X medium and Z medium and Y medium, and how do I like sharpen this into like a more legible a concept that's like really serving, not, I mean, serving you, but really serving the audience. Like you're in kind of a phase of trying to figure that out.
Yeah. And I think the Gen Z thing happened because I'm an ancient Gen Z. And so it became, I think, like just the label. It was like young person talks about young people.
Yeah. Wow.
Which has been, it's been fun. And I'm very grateful to like, you know, be able to hopefully share some of the things I hear from my audience and from the travels that I've done, from the stories of young people. But yeah, like that's just one part of it is like, you know, everyone wants to understand younger generations, and that's one part of it. But the whole goal I have is really like, okay, so we have young people, they're feeling bad. What do we do about it? It's not just like going on shows and being like, the young people are sad. It's like, how do we, you know, build a better economy for them and build a better system and structure? And what are they struggling with? And what is everybody struggling with in this time of like immense digital change and immense uncertainty from a policy level? And so a big goal of mine is just capturing that. Yeah. And then the mediums are important. And I was getting lazy, and I was just like putting stuff up, and I was like, this doesn't feel right. I don't feel like it's the correct way to capture this. And I'm very resistant to borrowing from other styles. Like, you know, the Talking Head YouTube is very popular, and I just was like, I don't want to be another talking head YouTube. Like, I think the main goal, if you're going to use social media as a tool and then also complain about how bad it is for people, like, you have to bring people somewhere. Mm-hmm. You have to get them out of the digital world somehow, whether that be through a book or whether that be through a video that brings them into the real world rather than just some room where you're sitting and talking about things. So that's been a big effort, is like, mm-hmm. how do I properly take people into the economy, teach them the lessons outside of a textbook. So yeah, it's very philosophical. Obviously, like, I spent a lot of time in my brain.
Yeah. But, okay. So on my, this is one of two podcasts I do. My other thing is Creator Spotlight, which is a newsletter / podcast owned by Beehive. And, you know, I research the creator economy, what are creators, et cetera. But one of my big shticks there is like defining creator, which I think I've read that, you know, people sometimes call you this, you sometimes balk at it. But the I kind of have two definitions. One, which is really broad, which is just like anybody contributing to the corpus of the internet. And then the second is a little more useful and like a definition I came up with for like, okay, who are the people I interview for that podcast and how, what are the questions I ask them, which is anybody, you know, creating and distributing digital media for an audience that they're trying to grow in earnest, that's beyond their immediate friends and family, who are also somehow monetizing it all, whether that's, you know, with typical like subscription or ad revenue, or even something as abstracted as like just trying to build a presence to as a resume to get a job, right? So I think in this way, I definitely see you as a creator bringing it back to friction. I think a lot about texture in digital media and like in newsletters, like with our newsletter, I think about it as like, have you ever been rock climbing?
Yes, I love rock.
So, uh-huh. you know, yeah. you there's like a course or a problem that's laid out, mm-hmm. and like you don't want to do one where it's just like a zero and it's just like basically a ladder straight up, right?
Yeah,
like, right. Let's say
you're
a
just,
three.
Like, walking on the rock.
Yeah, a three is much more compelling where there's like, it's kind of a problem you have to figure out and you like, you want to do it. And I don't know. So it sounds like slabs, what you're trying to do is like figure out what the texture of your work is that draws people in and like, I don't know, makes it like, what is the unique texture and style of your work, which having read parts of your book and, you know, your newsletters, whatever, like, to me, it is this like real world analogies that kind of like, I don't know, take these complex things and make them simple. But I don't know. I guess I'm just curious to like workshop this with you a little bit. Like, do you think it is YouTube? Clearly you love writing and you published a book.
Yeah.
I think you've hinted you're working on another one. But yeah, is it books and video? Is it more video? Is it more books? Like, what is it?
I don't know. I mean, I've loved writing since the beginning of my life. So I you know, I published mm-hmm. my first book when I was 8, and I think my mom was the only person who read it because it was bound. Yeah, Little Penguin. Yeah. So I've written forever and was a big like voracious reader and still am.
Same.
It's just like everybody's already said everything. And I think it's so beautiful to go back and see that. James Baldwin has a great quote about that, you know, like every sadness, every heartbreak that you think that you've have experienced, like somebody's already written about it. He said it so much more beautifully than I just did.
Yeah.
But and then I think like my thing is we have so many powerful mediums to communicate with people right now. AI could disrupt all of this. I have no idea. Like it could, you know, deepfake Kyla could be making videos here soon, which would make me
quite
sad.
No, let's hope not.
I hope not. But yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of power in video. And when I first started out, my videos were like super weird. Mm-hmm. So I was dressing up as Jerome Powell, who's the chair of the Federal Reserve. I was doing all of these skits. It's actually kind of funny. My friend Regina was talking about it the other day. She's like, it's so weird that you got your start like pretending to be Jerome Powell and now you have like op-eds in the New York Times.
Well, this to me too, this is like a Jack Corbett from Planet Money. He was one of the first like
Jack's
kind of like
so great.
Finance creator type of people, I guess, that I first started like learning from, where I was like, wow, this is such a good way to translate these concepts into like a scroll stopping way that I can understand
Dan
as somebody
Toomey.
Who doesn't know anything about this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dan Toomey from Morning Brew
Dan
is like another.
Great, yeah.
yeah. So like they're Dan Toomey and I did a couple of videos together at the beginning of like when we were both first starting, which is so crazy, but it was like, yeah, these skits. And so for me, like, I want to make sure I'm always, you know, keeping up with dial and pushing kind of the boundaries of like how you can talk about the economy. Because what's sort of interesting, like Dan Toomey has the incredible channel Good Work, yep, where I think they like really push the boundaries of business and like talking about economics and talking about things in that lens. But I think that there's a lot of like the thing that always blew my mind is nobody really makes art about economics. We all just kind of treat it as this like really static, archaic, boring thing.
Dusty science.
Right. And so, and there's like a really cool way to make art about it. And so that's my goal, is to like make art about the economy and do it in a way that reaches people, develop curriculum around it. You know, just how do you sort of just help people understand the world that they're in and bring them to the point where they want to understand that?
Yeah. Just a couple more questions. One, you did, so in that Friction essay, in the footnotes, you do explicitly hint that you're working on the outline of a new book, maybe around these same themes. What can you say about that?
Yeah, I can't say a lot, but I am just like working on... Newsletter subscribers will know that I kind of end up writing about like almost the same thing a lot of the times, but through a different lens. So a lot of like, yeah, because like you just have an obsession. Mm-hmm. And so my obsession is like digital media and how that's impacting young people and how it's impacting the economy. And so just a lot of my essays are coalescing around that point. And once you have a mass of essays, they can turn into a book. So yeah.
Classic way of writing a book, a little bit at a time. Okay. Also, I think last week you were at the 2025 Reagan National Economic Forum, which I had not heard of until I started preparing for this. You were moderating Scene Report, Vibe Report, What's Going On, Observations. Tell us about it.
Sure. Yeah. So it was the first RNF.
Okay.
So yeah. And then I got to moderate a panel with Douglas Holt-Eakin and Jason Furman. And we were the opener at 7 a.m. And it was really cool because
7 a.m. Wow.
Yeah. We were the coffee conversation. Yeah. And then after we did our panel, Doug and Jason totally killed it. They're incredible thinkers with such a breadth of experience. Like Doug was working during the Bush administration. Jason was Obama's chair of the Council of Economic Advisors and teaches at Harvard. So just like a wealth of knowledge. But after our panel, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan, came on and he just was like, we need to get it together, America. Like, you know, we don't need to worry about China. Like, our enemy is the enemy within. And it's like, oh, okay. And so the whole rest of the day was kind of that. Like, Mark Andreessen came on from A16Z, was saying quite similar things. There was a bunch of, like, just really excellent panels. And I think it was the first time that people have kind of been honest about some of the policies that are being put forward in terms of like the impact that it's going to have on the economy, the impact that it's going to have on trade. And so it was an excellent forum. And yeah, it was very, very interesting to hear all of those perspectives.
Nice. What do you mean they were being honest about some of the policies? Like what, in what way?
Well, you host podcasts, right? So mm-hmm. you know that people kind of like dance around topics sometimes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they weren't, I didn't notice that as much. There was some stuff where I was like Jamie Dimon was talking about how the wages for lower income workers haven't grown over the past 20 years, which is just like factually not true. Yeah. So there was like some stuff like that where it's like, okay, but he's, I think, preparing for a presidential run. He said he wasn't, but I was like, you're talking like you are. And it would be smart. Like if you look at Mark Carney in Canada, mm-hmm. Jamie Dimon could run that same playbook.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Last thing. We spent a lot of time, maybe somewhat pessimistically, talking about frictionlessism. Perhaps too long. Pessimistic. What are you optimistic about right now?
I mean, I'm always optimistic about like the human spirit. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I do love C.S. I mean, not unfortunately, I love C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, no shame.
I love, yeah, like I find a lot of hope in reading about the past and knowing that we've been here before. It's just like we have new demons that we have mm-hmm. to figure out where they fit and how we're going to manage them. And I think right now there's a lot of ostriching, like people are just putting their heads in the sand. And it's easy to do that. And it's much easier to go on a podcast and talk about it versus like actually doing something about it. Yeah. And so I'm optimistic that if we can sort of talk about these problems, begin to understand what they are, the issues that we're facing, you know, be able to have a podcast about them where we're able to talk in detail about where the issues are stemming from, then like we can provide solutions from that. So I think it's great that we have the problems clearly defined, because that means that the solutions are coming. Like, there's no easy answers, but there are simple answers, as Ronald Reagan once said.
I think too, I mean, this reminds me of the Baldwin quote you said, where it's like all every emotion has been felt before. And like the idea that there's nothing new, it's like, that's the point. I mean, people have probably been saying that for 3 million years, you know, there's nothing new. But I think the point of that is it's like, there's nothing new, but you just have to tell it in new ways, because not everybody is reading those same books, right? And you might read the like Ulysses and you're like, wow, I relate to this, whatever it is, some book from like 100 years ago. But like other people aren't going to read that, but maybe they'll read you. And the point is that like you tell these stories and surface your these ideas and these solutions, which may be the same solutions as previously, but people just forgot them or have never read them. So
eventually they'll stick.
Eventually they'll stick. That's a good place to end it. This has been Tasteland. Kyla, thank you for coming on. Is there anything else you'd like to plug though before we stop?
So I do have a book. It's available wherever books are sold. I have a newsletter, kyla.substack.com, and I do post short form videos across the short form video sites.
Check it out. Listeners, we will see you next week. Thank you.